Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, of course, Brian J. Rowan, and with me, as always, my two cohorts, Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hello.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Do you have my chems?
You need the greens or the blues, man.
Blues. I need the blue chems.
That's a little taste of what we're probably going to be talking about a lot during our review of this week's primary film, The Bourne Legacy. But before we get into that, I'd like to introduce our special guest for this week. We have Chris Campbell from Movies.com joining us.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey. Hello.
Good evening.
All right. So, yeah, like we said, we're going to be talking about The Bourne Legacy this week. But to anyone who's been here before, you should already know. And to anyone who hasn't, I will now inform you. We like to kick things off first with a discussion topic related to film. And before we get into that, though, I just want to say again, as I always say, because I can't tell you people this enough, you should definitely subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, and if you ever have cause to talk to us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. This week's discussion topic, which we're going to get into now, we wanted to look at the history of the Bourne movies as kind of a pop art reaction to the War on Terror. Not only the Bourne films, but most films in general. I think we can agree that the reaction to the War on Terror and the way that it's gone has influenced a lot of films that have come out, especially one film in particular that just released its trailer this week, Zero Dark Thirty. Let's start off with Danny. No. Let's start off with our guest this week. Chris, how have you felt about the Bourne film specifically and most films in general as far as being a reaction to the War on Terror? Do you think that that's a fair assumption to make? And if so, do you think any have been more successful than others?
Well, I mean, the Bourne films, it's interesting because, you know, they're based on books that are from the Cold War era. So the fact that they were adapted to responding to the War on Terror, I think, is pretty interesting. I love when you can turn any kind of pop cultural material into a response to what's going on now. Honestly, I think that any kind of action movies coming out now should be a response to what's going on in the real world. I think right now we're at a time where people think it's kind of overreaching to think that everything is in reference to the War on Terror or post 9/11 or whatever. But, you know, that's the world we live in. I think that the Bourne movies probably the most intelligent, you know, with dealing with action and responding to current events, and that they have a lot of material dealing with the intelligence, the incompetence of intelligence. It really plays on both the competency and the incompetency. Like, when I think of action movies that really represented their era, I think of, like, the 80s movies and dealing with the Cold War era and the politics of that time. So I'm trying to think of some other titles right now. I'm blanking, unfortunately, for films in the last 10 years.
I was going to say, does anyone really have, like, a list of definitive movies they feel that came out that have, like, dealt with this in a meaningful way that weren't already mentioned?
I wish I could say Green Zone, but movie's bad.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's more of a fantasy about how it could have been avoided.
But you know what? You know what I wanted to say was, but what I think happened in the last 10 years, and, you know, I compare a lot of it to the action movies of the 80s, and, you know, action movies of the 80s really, really referenced post-Vietnam. You know, Rambo was from Vietnam, and he went in and took on and, you know, made up for our loss in Vietnam very directly. And, you know, he was a Vietnam vet. And a lot of action heroes in the 80s kind of had that reference to Vietnam. Whereas, you know, the Bourne movies and, say, like, Iron Man, you know, they kind of remind us of the War on Terror and terrorists without really pointing any fingers and without really making a direct reference to Al-Qaeda or, you know, specific groups or specific countries that we fought in. And anytime that we have tried to do that or tried to have a smart film or even, like, you know, The Green Zone, which I haven't seen, that's very directly referencing it, are usually not that popular. So you kind of have to have that balance now where you're smart and you're a fun movie that could be more timeless and doesn't directly remind you. I mean, it kind of reminds you of the War on Terror without really, like, trying to be a comment on the exact War on Terror that we're going through now.
I was going to say that that's a good point because, like Rambo, you know, that's someone going back and doing it right. Whereas the Bourne movies and Green Zone and things like that are more about like atonement. I mean, Iron Man specifically is about someone who profits off of this military industrial complex and who tries to fix it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's about people who engage in this and then suddenly have like a change of conscience and they're still fighting it in a way, but it's to make up for the mistakes that have been made in the past.
Mm-hmm. You know what? What's that Peter Berg movie that I really loved?
The Kingdom?
I can't think of what it's called. Yeah, The Kingdom. That kind of was that sort of same fantasy where it was like, what if we had been able to go in and do this right away? Mm-hmm. You know, take these terrorists right away. Like, we, right after 9/11, we knew it was these people. We went and we did it.
Yeah. I think that is a particularly important example because it sort of masks, I don't want to say masks, but it envelops that in pure entertainment, which I think is why it was able to do moderately well. It's sort of a, I don't want to say a concession that you have to make if you want to make a film of that sort, but it's something that you have to be aware of, and I think it's also something many filmmakers are very much trying to lean toward, is that second layer of it. Because if it's a straight thriller that doesn't have the big action scenes, it might be kind of a turnoff, which I think has been shown time and time again in the box office receipt, which very much speaks to the Bourne series as well.
Yeah, because the Bourne series, I mean, as much as we're talking about it in this way, I think most people remember it for the fight scenes and the car chases. But I mean, especially in the later movies, there's a definite sense of self-recrimination coming from it, wherein, you know, the hero was born... Oh God, I didn't mean to make that pun, and I apologize. He was born of the need to have someone who's capable of fighting, you know, a new kind of enemy and making these sacrifices. And yet, it seems like his greatest enemy is his own distrusting government. So it's this weird way of sidestepping the issue, because you never really see him engaging in any meaningful way with the people he was really supposed to be. And instead, it's all about him being used and abused and either trying to get away or trying to get his revenge. And I just feel like that's kind of where we're at. Like, I feel like we don't feel comfortable really discussing what we're doing. So in an attempt to get away from that, we've made ourselves our own worst enemy. It's kind of especially true in The Hurt Locker. Because, I mean, as much as that movie revolves around the disabling of IEDs, I mean, the real, I guess, antagonist of that film is Jeremy Renner's character. Like, he is the one causing the most problems, and he is the person who we focus on, and we see that it's not the war in any, like, specific sense. It's not this war, but it's just the act of going to war that is giving him the most trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible, given all of the, I would say, popular misgivings regarding the War on Terror, to make a movie that directly addresses it in a way that can both kind of reflexively kind of slap us on the wrists for our own major faults in going forward in it, while at the same time delivering on any kind of entertainment level? I mean, is Zero Dark Thirty, do you think, possibly the film that will give us that finally?
Well, Zero Dark Thirty has a happy ending. Perhaps,
it does have the closest possible happy Hollywood ending, I suppose. The bad guy does get got.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, because think about how many movies there are that actually do deal with that. The one that sticks out the most in my mind is Brian De Palma's Redacted. Has anybody ever seen that movie?
I have.
No.
Yeah, not a lot of people have. It got really buried upon its release and got not great reviews either. But I do like that film, and that deals directly with the War on Terror and what's going on over there, one very specific, terrible case. And it bombed. Nobody saw that film whatsoever because people just don't want that in their multiplexes. Even though that didn't play in a multiplex still, people don't want to see that in films because you want to get away from reality in that instance, and that's putting it right in your face, particularly the very ending of that film. So, no, I don't think it's possible.
Because we had these Cold War thrillers that treaded that same ground, and I don't know why we were more accepting of them back then. I mean, if you were to run down a list of every serious-minded, vaguely possible action, or at least, you know, supposed to be entertaining film that's come out about this that has not done well,
mm-hmm.
you could basically go on all day. Lions for Lambs, In the Valley of Law. God, what was the one with Jake Gyllenhaal? Brothers.
Yeah.
Jarhead, to some extent. you know, it takes place during the first one, but it's kind of obvious that it's a comment on this one. Yeah. Danny, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I'd just like to go back to the Bourne, kind of how this relates to the Bourne movies really quick. And if you guys don't mind, I'd like to quote something really quick.
No, go for it.
That's cool. This is from Nick LaSalle's review of The Bourne Legacy, and he's the critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. And the end of his review basically really speaks to what we're talking about. He says, "Meanwhile, what are we to make of this recurring nightmare that we see in movie after movie, in which the government is depicted as a bunch of jerks in suits, looking at various screens and trying to figure out how to assassinate people all over the world?" What that reveals to me, like, about these Bourne movies is, if you think about the characters that are played by, like, Brian Cox or Chris Cooper or Edward Norton in this one, it's like they really don't have personalities. They're kind of just like stick figures that tell people what to do. To me, that kind of reflects this atmosphere that's been going around in movies like this, which is this atmosphere of people that just really don't trust their government and kind of despise them. And it's kind of like Chris was saying this a little bit, but a lot of these movies are less about explicitly talking about the war on terror as opposed to just evoking this atmosphere of, like, conspiracy and people doing, like, sleight of hand things to just get ahead themselves. Another movie I watched recently that kind of has this atmosphere is Syriana. It's like, it's an incredibly hard to follow movie. It's really hard to understand the logic of it on a scene by scene basis, but what you get is this atmosphere of people doing things to get ahead themselves and not help everyone else. And since these are government workers, the implication is that they just want to support their own, to, like, you know, wash their own back. That's something that definitely comes through in the Bourne movies for me, even if they are action-driven primarily.
Yeah, you know, you're quoting him. I wanted to kind of close us out on this final thought that was really put well by Scott Mendelson at Mendelson's Memos. And he has an entire, I guess, you know, a blog post about the idea of the paranoid political thriller and how it's been damaged by a national apathy. And he closes out by saying, in today's 24-hour news cycle, genuine scandal only shocks us until the next real or imagined scandal pops up, with few, if any, actual consequences. The classical political conspiracy thriller no longer works in these dark times. We already know just how low our government can stoop. Parenthetically, I'll add, earlier on, he talked about everything that's been done in the war on terror that should be pretty atrocious to us. And his final line is, "We just choose not to care." So, a final thought to close out, is apathy one of the reasons that we can't grasp onto this? Is it not just that we don't want the story, but that even if we were given a good film like that, we can't even think about it mattering as much as the film would like us to think?
I don't know if I've ever looked at it from that perspective.
I was about to say, I know it's a dark question, but I think it's a good way to close out before we start talking about the Bourne legacy. If someone doesn't speak, I'm going to start calling names.
I want to point out, I mean, I don't know if this answers this question exactly or just contributes to what we were talking about in general, but as a documentary critic, primarily, I could say that, and I can't remember who it was that I read this week that said something about how, you know, popular movies shouldn't tell you things or really, like, directly deal in real subject matter. They should just make you feel about something. And, you know, to have these films that deal in apathy and deal in more of an atmosphere and a feeling, you know, if you want a film, and people really don't, and this is why they don't go to see them, if you want a film that really directly deals with the war on terror and politics and a lot of serious subjects, you know, there's like a billion documentaries that have come out in the last 10 years, and most of them nobody went to see. You know, and so they're not going to go see a movie like Lions for Lambs or any of those films that try to really directly deal with this stuff. And people want to have more of an escape with the movies right now, and, you know, apathy is an escape in a way. And, you know, if you can go watch an action movie that's going to have a subtext and you can have that feeling of what's going on in the world right now, but still not think about it that directly, that's going to be a lot more appealing to people.
Mm-hmm. I guess one last thing I want to mention. If you think about it, I guess Paul Greengrass really is the reigning war on terror filmmaker, because you look at The Bourne Identity, which came out only 9 months after 9/11 and was obviously made before that. But then when he got his hands on the series, it suddenly became much more steeped in that post 9/11 world. And then, you know, between Supremacy and Ultimatum, he made United 93. And after Ultimatum, he made Green Zone. And now he's making Captain Phillips, which deals with terrorism in a certain sense, even if it's drunk pirates, which, you know, might be a little more amusing than United 93 or something. But it is interesting to see him take that mantle up for himself in a way. I guess I'd like to see where he goes from there, because will he keep up that political streak, or is he going to slow down and, I don't know, make a beach comedy or something? But I think it's fascinating to consider what he's been able to do in the course of just 8 years.
Well, I don't know if you ever saw it, but his first film that I'm aware of was Bloody Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like politics and, strangely enough, like violence and, you know, just the state of the world are kind of in his storytelling DNA. I don't know that he'll ever back away from it fully.
Mm-hmm.
Though I'm sure that he could shoot a damn good volleyball scene. All right. On that closing note, I think we'll close out this discussion. If you all at home have any thoughts or inputs that you'd want to put into this, you know where to reach us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. But now that that has been taken care of, we can move into our feature review, which, as I said earlier, and as I'm sure you all can guess, is of The Bourne Legacy, which is directed and written by Tony Gilroy, starring Jeremy Renner and Rachel Weisz.
What do you think that we do out there, Doc?
Jason Bourne was the tip of the iceberg.
It's Aaron Cross. We have never seen evaluations like this. He's Treadstone without the inconsistency.
I've never met anybody in the program.
So how many of us are there?
You asked too many questions.
Jason Bourne is in Manhattan.
Confirmed.
What?
That's all I have. Gotta go.
Okay, so this is the fourth film in, I guess we're just going to call it the Bourne series now, since we can't really call it the Bourne trilogy. Jason Bourne, not really anywhere to be seen. This movie takes place concurrently with the Bourne Ultimatum and features Jeremy Renner as Aaron Cross, who is another one of these super soldiers in one of a seemingly innumerable number of special programs that has been put forward by the government to create the best possible warrior. This film, I'm sure, will give us a lot of things to talk about, perhaps not as much on a subtext level as our discussion would lead you to believe, but I believe definitely on a narrative level, or lack thereof. But let's kick this off with Danny. What did you think of The Bourne Legacy?
Well, let's start with the title, because as you said, Jason Bourne isn't in it. And as you said, it takes place the same time frame as Greengrass's movie. So Bourne can't really even have a legacy yet. So just right off the bat, the title's
the claws are out already.
A bit of a warning sign. But overall, I think the movie just doesn't work because Jeremy Renner doesn't really have a character to do anything with.
Got to find his chems.
Yeah, because, well, the movie is built around the idea, obviously, that there are like dozens of these Jason Bourne-like super agents. And I don't think that's necessarily an uninteresting idea, but the problem is, when the film asks us to engage with Jeremy Renner and Rachel Weisz, there's really nothing there. And you can kind of tell this because they introduce Jeremy Renner at the beginning of the movie and he's kind of like hiking through Alaska and he's a blank slate. You really know nothing about him. And then when the end of the movie comes 2 hours later, you try and think of things that you know now that you didn't know when he was hiking through the mountains, and he's basically just the same blank slate that you don't really have much interest in. So yeah, I think overall it's just not very engaging and kind of just trying to tread water with this material.
All right. Nick, what about yourself?
I think Mr. King took the words right out of my mouth. The film, I found much of it to be kind of plodding and overly familiar. Biggest disappointment with this movie is the fact that Tony Gilroy is very clearly aping the Paul Greengrass style. There's not necessarily the same amount of like shaky cam or obscure sound during conversation scenes, but in terms of just the more basic formal elements, cinematography is exactly the same. The just sort of the structure of the movie feels very Bourne-like. The action scenes look exactly the same, and the dialogue feels like it's ripped right from it, which I suppose is not necessarily a huge problem because
in the latter sense, because I don't want it to. Complete deviation, but I wanted something a little new, and I don't think this movie delivers that at all. It just feels like they took a script for a fourth Bourne movie, they went into the, you know, search mode on their word processor, deleted Jason Bourne, put in Aaron Cross, and then sent it out. I mean, can anybody honestly tell me what about this film separates it from the first three? I've been asking people, and they just, even people who like it, say, oh, well, it's similar, but I kind of liked getting more of that. But I guess I didn't want that. I wanted something that felt fresh and felt like a continuation, if not necessarily a complete copy.
I agree with both of you.
No ma.
I agree with both of you pretty heavily. But before we get into my thoughts, Chris, why don't you fill us in on your initial impression of The Bourne Legacy?
Okay. Well, I mean, I love the movie, so I'll put it right there. I think it's very different from the other Bourne movies, to disagree with you all completely.
All right.
I do agree that Aaron Cross is a very blank slate character, not really any character at all there. I don't think that he needs to be. I think he's pretty much a drone, really. Like, they show you the drone, the flying drone at the beginning of the movie. I think that's just a reference to what we're going to be seeing in terms of a character through the whole movie. But I don't think that he's the protagonist of the movie. I think Rachel Weisz is. And I think that that's where this movie is different from the first Bourne movie, or the first Bourne character, in that they're not after Aaron Cross in this movie. They're after Rachel Weisz's character, who I don't remember her name. So I guess there's something to that. But you meet her and...
It's Marta Shearing.
Marta Shearing. Okay. You know, they try to kill her at the beginning of the movie, and then they're trying to make sure that she's dead. And Aaron Cross is there, and, you know, he needs his Kens, and he's there, and he can protect her, whatever. But I'm mostly fascinated by the, in terms of what's different from the other movie, is that she's not just a tag-along in the way that, you know, the female lead is in Bourne Identity. I think she's the most changed character from beginning to end, although, you know, still there's not a whole lot there. You don't get a whole lot to know about her. But the only, like, real character development scenes that you have in the movie are her scenes in the lab and her scene in, I mean, I don't know how much spoilers you guys do in this podcast. There's a scene where she's being interrogated and you find out more from her there, and that's, like, definitely her scene. So I was just more drawn to her character, and, you know, she's a great actress, and she has a lot of personality in the film, and much better to look at than Jeremy Renner, in my opinion. So maybe I'm just, like, drawing into that. And, you know, like, I don't think this film is necessarily an engaging film in terms of, like, action movies. You should just sit there and relax your mind and let a movie take you in. I don't think it does that. And so maybe by not being engaged and being a little bit confused in the beginning, I tried to engage myself and tried to find things that were interesting to me. And that was one of the things that interested me, was her storyline in the film. You know, all the stuff about him being a drone, and, you know, he's basically a robot. You know, these super soldiers are basically, they're being made to be human robots. They're given either training or psychological testing or drugs or whatever to make them smarter and more physically agile, but not have any emotion or feeling. So they're basically being turned into robots. And in the same way that a drone is, sometimes these robots can become unpredictable. We can lose control over them, or we can make mistakes with them. Or, you know, the drone at the beginning of the movie hits a target. They think that they got their man, and they didn't. Same thing happens in the real world with drones. There's another scene where a house blows up, and it takes them so long to figure out that the people that they are trying to kill weren't killed in the explosion. So there's a lot of that, like, confusion and incompetency with intelligence, that kind of technology of fighting wars or fighting things from a distance. We're sending out robots or remote control type things and trying to fight from home, and we can't always really know what's going on. So that stuff interested me.
See, I like that as an idea. And I think that the movie definitely has that idea, but
right.
I don't know that it really carries it off as well as it could have. I agree with you, however, that the acting in this movie is pretty damn good. I was a huge fan of Rachel Weisz in this. She's great in basically everything she's in, so not a huge surprise. But I did appreciate how she was able to kind of modulate the shaken up screaming woman role with a person who actually does know what she's doing in some way. You know, because whenever you have a female lead in these, you're always concerned that she's just going to be that the shrieking sidekick that the person has to keep alive for seemingly no reason whatsoever. So I was glad to see that they were able to steer her away from that. I mean, Jeremy Renner, obviously, in a physical sense, carries off this role very well. I mean, he didn't do anything that seemed as though it would be too much out of his wheelhouse. The things you were talking about, though, and I think one of the bigger problems I had with this film was just this idea of it being a Bourne movie, whereas... Sure, the Bourne situation sets off the obstacles that Aaron Cross is going to have to get over, but his actions have almost no bearing on anything that happens outside of a few random things. Like, there's no interplay between the films. It's all very one-sided. And it seems as though they're setting this up to come back, but mm-hmm. they don't deliver on it well enough in this movie. They seem to really be trying to set this up almost as just like a tasting portion of what could come. It's almost like they're trying to say, hey, look, we can make a Bourne movie just as well as the other Bourne movies. We just have to actually know what story we're telling. But you should definitely come back because next time we'll have the story. Which,
next week on Bourne.
Exactly. This is like the first four episodes of a new season of television. Like, it's weird to me that it really does go, and we can get more into this in spoilers, which we'll get into probably in the next couple minutes. But it goes somewhere and it ends. And I was just kind of blown away because I was like, I know I've been sitting here for 2 hours and it's kind of felt like it, but I don't feel like we're done yet. this is only like maybe halfway through the second act. And that really weighed on me. Mm-hmm. And it really destroyed a lot of the things that I think could have been good about the film. This idea, especially Aaron Cross, whose original name was Kenneth Kitsum, he is the perfect cipher on which to place this idea, this analogy of people used as drones just as much as, you know, technology used as drones, for a reason that we can get into in spoilers. But again, they only give us so many glances back at him that you never really get time to use Danny's, you know, analogy. He's a blank slate, and someone starts to write like half of a sentence on him and then just stops. So it's enough right. for you to start filling in ideas, but never enough for you to know whether or not the movie really had an idea of what he was doing. Am I the only one who felt that way?
No, I feel the same way. There's sort of the idea that he didn't have the biggest brain in his head, and they added something like 12 points to his IQ to make him eligible, but which is kind of an interesting idea. And then that's sort of explored with the pills and how a lot of people have compared it to Flowers for Algernon, which I can sort of say.
That's a very good point, yes.
But there's not enough of that, because I feel like once it gets down to fighting mode, there's just fighting. There's not a lot of thinking going on for the rest of the film. He's traveling around, he's snapping security guards' necks, he's running around on a motorcycle, and then it's roll credits. You don't really know who this guy is or how this is affecting his life. I mean, there's that scene where he's telling Rachel Weisz, oh, you can't call anybody you know because they'll become a target. And it's an interesting idea, and it almost felt as though, I don't want to make inferences about things that aren't there, but it almost felt as though he had that experience himself, or he had to leave this whole life behind and a family and whatnot. And that would separate him from Jason Bourne. That would make him a unique character, is if you explore the idea of maybe he had a mother or a wife or a kid or something. But then it just gets down to, oh, he's got to go to Manila because he's got to get his chems. And after that, I was ready for it to end at that point, because I was thinking, oh, okay, so you're just gonna tell me this story again. Huh. Okay, I have the DVDs back at home, you know. I could just pop those in. Yeah, that was the most disappointing aspect for me, was Aaron Cross as a character, basically.
Okay. I think we're getting to the point where, to really dive into this, we're going to need to get into spoilers. I don't know that anything we've said right now has been too much of a spoiler, but we'll just give the spoiler warning anyway. Before we do that, though, before we make the hard break into real hardcore spoiler territory, recommendations on this film? I personally have told people in my actual life that they should, you know, wait for DVD or HBO. So that's mine. I mean, it's not bad. It's vaguely entertaining from time to time, as far as I'm concerned. But the flaws, I think, for me, keep it from getting a full recommend. What does everyone else think?
I would say I didn't really, even though I ultimately didn't like the film, I didn't really feel the length that much. I didn't mind watching it because it's mildly entertaining. It's more like when the second it ends, I thought, oh, that's...
All right. That's going to be your pull quote on this movie's poster.
Yeah.
All right, Danny, what about yourself?
I would really recommend going back and watching the first three ones and then not going to see this one.
All right. And Chris, what about yourself?
I definitely highly recommend it. And, you know, I wanted to say that another way that I think this is different that you guys reminded me of is in the first movie, Bourne is the one with amnesia. He's trying to figure out what's going on. And this one, he's a blank slate, so we're trying to figure out what's going on. And, you know, I get accused all the time of seeing things that aren't in the movie or putting my own ideas into a movie. And I think that's part of what movies are, you know, mm-hmm. especially if something is, I mean, if I'm going to go see a movie that maybe this is a blank slate, then I'm going to find other things to look at it. And I don't know. I think that if you want to, you can engage yourself in this movie and find smart ideas, even if they're just ideas, you know, and even if it just triggers you to think about things differently through the rest of the movie where you're not even paying that much attention to the fight scenes, because I don't really pay that much attention to fight scenes. They kind of bore me. Ideas trigger other things in me, and that's what I like about this movie.
Actually, that's a good lead into the spoiler section for me, because I will say that if there is a sequel to this movie, I will see it, because I am interested in this character. The things that they do with him that give hints as to who he might be are really intriguing. Since we're in spoilers, we can just now come out and say it. I mean, the chems, oh Lord, the chems. Throughout the movie, he's taking these pills, the greens and the blues. The greens were for his physical attributes, which apparently he was able to viral off of.
Yeah.
And this is a real thing they do in gene therapies, you know, give a virus something to stimulate and change. So I liked that. I appreciated that, because it's not something you usually see a lot of in action films. Now, the blues are the mental, which, oddly enough, to him is the more important thing, because as Nick said, when he was recruited into the military in the first place, the recruiter was looking to make a quota, and they just randomly added 10, 12 points to his IQ just to get him to the minimum for enlistment. Which, again, this is one of those ideas that, if it's explored better, could make for a very sharp, I don't want to say it's not a satire. That's definitely not what it is. It could be a sharp observation about the tricks or the different ways that our military recruiting is resorting to now that, you know, being in the military is not, I guess, as romantic an option as it used to be. You know, this idea that you just got to push them in, and if they're a little deficient, it doesn't matter. Like, that's an interesting idea. And whereas Bourne, you get hints in his life that he maybe wasn't the best kind of guy, and he wanted to be in this program because he was just gung-ho about it. You know, this is a person who came almost out of desperation. They also make a mention of the fact that he was in a boys' home in Reno, Nevada. And the one real flashback you get to him pre-chems is him beat to shit and, you know, just wanting to say the right thing so that he can stay in the military and stay in this program that they are going to enroll him in. But again, you don't see enough of that. You don't see enough of him in a diminished state, or I shouldn't even say diminished state, an unaugmented state, for you to really get the stakes of him losing that. Like, we're told that he was mentally deficient. We're told that he knows that, I guess, withdrawing from the blues is a terrible thing. But the one indication that we get of that is a moment on a catwalk where he just pauses and stares off into space for a little bit. So there are no stakes to this, really. Like, that was my main problem with this, is this idea that, sure, he's a guy who has something to lose, but we don't know what he will return to if he does lose it. Did anyone else get that feeling, or am I just looking too much into this?
I can see it. I think it speaks to my problem, where I wanted to see him in the before state, and maybe you would like to see what happened in the after portion. So maybe we're on the same wavelength here.
I think it is. Because it should be one and the same. It should be, you know, starts in a valley, gets to a peak, and then crashes to the valley again. You need to see mm-hmm. either the first valley or the second valley to really understand what he's going through.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that we've talked about, this idea of him being a blank slate to us, but not to himself. I mean, like Nick said, you know, this, I think it was you, Nick. He tells Rachel Weisz that she can't call anyone. You know, she has to cut ties with everyone. She seems upset about this, and he seems to be speaking from experience. Not only that, but she asks a number of questions about June Monroe, which is her new alias. And it's the kind of setup that in any other movie you think, okay, end of second act, I'm going to learn who this woman is, and suddenly things will be changed, and I'll have a new investment in this character, and then that will make the climax even more intense. And that never comes. There's never a point where they explain that. It's completely dropped. And it may come back in the next film, but I personally think that is bullshit. I feel like if I'm there, if you've got me in this theater, you owe me a full story.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of this film, as I came to understand it, was one junkie's quest for a permanent hit.
Yeah.
That is dark.
It is dark.
That is bleak, Brian.
I apologize.
It's especially disappointing if you read or see interviews with Tony Gilroy about this movie. He's really, really excited about the idea that you can tell like a third of a story in the film now. He said that he thinks it's great about how a character will call somebody on a phone, and then you can, in the next movie, you can see the phone being picked up. He actually said that. That excites him, and maybe that makes him the perfect filmmaker for this franchise, but maybe that's a sign this franchise... maybe there should have just been one.
But there was never just one.
Maybe there should have just been one. It turns out there was like 10, actually.
Well, there was Treadstone, which is the first and second film, and then there's Blackbriar. Now there's Outcome, and then after that, there's Larks. This movie is ingenious in that it has set up literally an infinite amount of sidequels, which is a word I hate, and spinoffs that could possibly be made off of this series.
You know what? Everybody's an agent.
The world is a sleeper.
This franchise could go on for until the end of time.
I just want to say, like, people are really critical of the way franchises are working in this era. And, you know, it's coming up a lot lately about how, well, this film ended totally in a way that sets up a sequel. Well, yeah, that's how Hollywood works now. And it's also what appeals to people about television right now. And I think that Hollywood is probably trying to tap into some of that appeal of television.
Definitely. Like,
that idea that you're going to keep coming back and keep coming back. I mean, they've always wanted you to keep coming back for franchises anyways. They've always been... or at least, you know, in the last couple of decades, have been really, really obsessed with making sequels and such. That quote from Tony Gilroy, though, he should really be making television if that's really what he thinks. Because movies take so much longer to make. We don't remember things as well week to week. We don't get recaps in the way. I mean, the way that people were confused about the beginning of Bourne Legacy and the way that it makes you need to know some stuff that's going on in the last film or last two films, like, we audiences don't have that kind of memory for films, especially, I mean, that last one came out 5 years ago.
Yeah,
so that's a long time to expect people to remember what these clips are and what these different ideas were and whatnot. So I'm okay with the idea. I really love the idea of franchises and sequels now. I don't know. I can't really explain it. Maybe it is television's fault, or maybe it's just that I'm always intrigued on what's going to happen next, especially with, you know, this movie does set up a lot of things that I want to find out more about in the same way that certain TV shows do. But I don't know if it really works for cinema yet.
Yeah, what you said about, I had the same thought that you did, Gilroy saying that means he should be on television for exactly the reason you said. When someone rings someone on a phone, if the scene ends for a television show, you only have a week to wait. Or if it's, you know, the hiatus period, you know, during the holidays, 3 weeks. A movie, on the other hand, could be 3 years. You know, we all were clamoring for a sequel to The Dark Knight. That took 3 years to come out.
Four.
That took 4 years to come out. Thank you, Nick. I mean, these are issues that have to be dealt with. I understand that, you know, we're in like a television renaissance, and things like The Wire and Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
I have to stop you for a second. Why did you give renaissance a French pronunciation?
I have absolutely no idea.
A renaissance? I've never heard somebody pronounce renaissance that way before.
Okay. But I apologize to you, Nick.
I'm not offended. I don't object. I just find it kind of funny. Anyway.
So please, renaissance.
Please continue.
But I mean, these are shows that, I'm sorry, I forgot Lost, the most obvious thing that we should be adding in here. These are things that do thrive off that, and they do keep people coming back, because it is that weird setup of, like, constant escalating reward. But there's a difference here. Like, I think the prime example of this, and the way that serialization and franchising could work, would be in the most recent sense, the Pirates of the Caribbean films. Because the first one, I didn't like it that much, but it was a complete story. Like, it ended, and things had happened, yeah. And there was a resolution. The second they knew that they were going to get sequels out of it, they immediately made a 5-hour movie and then just cut it down the middle into 2 2.5-hour movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the wrong way to do it. We wanted to come back because we cared about these characters, because we'd seen them in a narrative arc. We didn't come back because we absolutely had to know what was going to happen after, like, they sailed off into the sunset. I don't remember how the first Pirates of the Caribbean ended, so I don't know if that's the last scene. I'm assuming, though. It wasn't that. We weren't like, well, what are they going to find over the horizon? It was just, these people are cool. We would like to spend more time with them, please. That's what you should be going for. You shouldn't be going for 30-minute action scene ends, and now, hey, I guess we have to do something else now because we're stuck on a Thai fisherman's boat. Like, that's a bad way to end a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of on board with this film until it did that to me. And yes, I say to me because I did take this personally.
See, I have no...
I think the only thing I'm going to say real quick, the only reason why I think that this movie ends on such a note that people are dissatisfied with, because the narrative arcs of the two main characters, really, they end. And they're going off in the sunset, and we're done with their story. You know, one guy got his permanent chems, the other character survived, you know, and they're going off and they could just live happily ever after. We don't need a sequel ever. But the fact that there's no real, like, villain or climax of the sort that's a conflict of that nature, you know, the conflicts are very, they're very one-sided. So I think that might lead to some of the dissatisfaction.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with
you. With the way that there's no third act, quote, from most people. Most people are saying there's no third act to that movie.
I agree with you because, like I said, in the story that I set up for this film, one junkie's quest for a permanent fix, I mean, that is concluded, and Rachel Weisz is still alive. So that's true. Those stories have been told. But the problem is that the movie didn't set that up seemingly to be the main thrust of its narrative. It really did seem like at some point you were going to get that Matt Damon moment where he's looking through the scope of a rifle at Edward Norton and just be like, I know what you did, and I'm coming for you. This movie was what you're right. There was no antagonist for them to battle. It was them attempting to achieve someone trying to stop them with one guy who never got into a fist fight with Jeremy Renner, which I was looking forward to because that's kind of what these films were known for. Like the moment where the two super soldiers would have to viciously beat one another to death. And instead we get Rachel Weisz kicking his bike. And I mean, that's okay, it's fine, but like, you only had that one guy who never spoke any dialogue, and you know Edward Norton's out there somewhere just being like, ah, we still gotta shut this thing down. But like, the enemy technically hasn't been thwarted, and it's just, there's this feeling in the pit of my stomach, like, I haven't seen what I was supposed to see in this. That bums me out a little bit.
I think it was a bold move. I also think that if people are gonna say it didn't do what the other Bourne movies did, that's kind of hypocritical in the same, you know, for people to criticize that and then also criticize it for not being different enough from the Bourne movies. Do you want it to be like a Bourne movie or do you not want it to be like a Bourne movie? And I think it's very bold in doing certain things that it did.
I can agree with that. I mean, the second that I said...
I like when movies piss people off, though.
No, I can agree with you on that. Like, the fact that there was no, I guess, like, mini-boss fight where they have to do the fists and everything, I mean, that made sense. Like, there is enough of a breakaway from the Bourne films that it doesn't feel to me as much as it did, you know, the find and replace function. I don't know. Like I said, there's something about it and the way that it's set up where there are these people trying to kill this guy, and you'd think that the story would be him not wanting to die, but they add this chem thing in, and that becomes the story, and that's what it fixates on, and that's where it goes throughout its entire run.
Yeah. I wish it was less like a Bourne movie, to be honest, because that's my biggest complaint, is that it feels too much like one. Kind of a bummer.
All right, well, I think we've talked this thing to death.
Can I make one more
defense
of the chems, the whole chems thing? Because some of this stuff, and sort of the Bourne idea made me think of this, is that, and this relates back to the whole War on Terror time, although it goes back a little bit before then. It all reminds me of a documentary that I've seen and learned all about how soldiers are trained now to just not even be humanistic. Because back in World War II, people's emotions got in the way of them being able to kill someone. So soldiers now are trained to be killing machines. They don't really have a way of
pulling them back into society. So I like that in The Bourne Legacy, they're like, well, you know what? We built these soldiers, and now we can't use them anymore, so we're just going to kill them. Because we can't reintroduce them into society. There's no way to do it. So I thought of the Chems as being sort of related to that. And, you know, in terms of like a MacGuffin and a very basic way of telling the story, I can see where that's an issue. And I know I'm probably drawing more thoughts out of it or putting more thoughts into it than were actually there. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, that idea of these people being made into tools, and when you no longer have a use for a tool, you destroy it or throw it out. I mean, they call Jason Bourne a Ferrari that was used like a lawnmower. And I think that gives you a good insight into these people's minds. I mean, again, though, that's something I feel like was explored pretty well in the first three movies, but not so much here.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I said, I think we might have talked this to death. Does anyone else have any final thoughts on this that they'd like to throw out before we get into the week ahead?
One last note about franchise building. I don't ever mind if you set up a sequel, because you look at a film like, I don't know, Back to the Future, which, sure, it was never necessarily meant to have a follow-up, but even the ending leaves room for it, and it's kind of a fun little bit to have when the film concludes. But I still want a reason to see a sequel. I want to see a sequel, you know? And at the end of The Bourne Legacy, I felt like I got the full story by that point. And the fact that it's so clearly trying to give us another one, it feels like there's a miscommunication going on.
All right. Danny, do you have any final thoughts on this?
Just to say one more quick word about Gilroy. Part of why this movie is so bland to me is because it tells me nothing new about who he is as like a filmmaker. Because if you look at what he's directed before, like Michael Clayton and Duplicity, both of those movies kind of have this tangible personality. And this movie, it's like he's written this movie before, and in terms of how he's directing it, as Nick mentioned earlier, he's trying to replicate the style in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So like it's just frustrating to watch this guy who's clearly talented to just not be able to stretch himself or in any way and just kind of keep doing what's familiar to him.
And yet he apparently was excited about this film and the future of storytelling.
Yeah, he loves it. Like, I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those are our thoughts on The Bourne Legacy. It's out in theaters now. Some of us think you should check it out. Some of us, maybe not. Now's the time when we can look forward to what's coming out in the week ahead. Coming to DVDs, we have The Raid, Kill List, Snowtown, and then a couple of TV series as well. One of which is Community, the complete third season, which you should buy because Community is a great show.
Mm-hmm. You're forgetting the biggest one of the week. Jaws is coming out on Blu-ray.
Oh, that's right. The Jaws Blu-ray, the re-release. It's
supposed to look pretty great.
It took me a minute to figure out what you just said. I was like, haven't we all seen Jaws? Don't we all know? Like, it doesn't look good. It is good. But you mean the transfer.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. Does anyone have any preferences for what's coming out on DVD that you think people should check out?
Really want to see Kill List. I'm quite excited for that one.
Snowtown, which is actually called The Snowtown Murders. Don't ask me why. But that's just like a straight up really good movie. That's very disturbing and bleak, but it's a serial killer movie with a really kind of interesting psychological bent. And it's a directorial debut, but definitely worth checking out.
Good week for Criterion as well. You got two Dardenne movies, Rosetta and Les Promesses. And The Royal Tenenbaums is coming out on Blu-ray.
Ah, damn it. I just bought that on regular DVD.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Ah.
That's my mistake for catching the Wes Anderson bug so soon after Moonrise Kingdom. I'll say that you should see The Raid, because that was a pretty awesome movie. And also, like I said, you should check out Community, because that's an awesome television show. Chris, did you have anything coming out that you think people should check out?
I definitely love The Raid, and I normally don't go for that kind of movie. You know, it's a pretty mindless film, but it's pretty crazy and entertaining. Paradise Lost 3, Oscar-nominated documentary, comes out this week also.
Oh, it does.
I know they're stretching the franchise out to three movies. It's crazy, but you know, I definitely recommend the fin- the final installment and the whole thing if you haven't seen any of the films.
All right, excellent.
There's never just one. There were three.
Good Lord. Speaking of Never Just One, coming out this weekend to theaters, we have The Expendables 2.
No.
I figured that there would be a reaction to that. We also have Paranorman, the newest stop-motion effort from Laika, who brought us Corpse Bride and Coraline. Not so much a fan of Corpse Bride, personally, but Coraline was really good, so I'm looking forward to Paranorman. We also have Sparkle, Cosmopolis, which actually looks good, Compliance, Robot and Frank, and then, I mean, like, some of these are limiteds that we've talked about before that are just rolling out more. But yeah, does anyone have any picks for this weekend that they want to throw out there?
Can't wait for Cosmopolis. I'm seeing it on Monday, and I'm all excited and stuff.
this is another point where I could say something about me being the host of this and why don't I get to go to these screenings, but I've just grown tired of it.
No, keep reinforcing that idea because Jordan will listen, and then he'll get in contact or something. Keep saying it. Just drop that bomb.
All right. I am the host of this goddamn podcast. Why am I not getting these? No, I really want to see Cosmopolis. Unfortunately, I live in D.C., not New York or L.A. I have the wrong, you know, dual-lettered city. But yeah, like I said, Paranorman, and who knows, I might get drunk and go watch The Expendables too.
You could smoke crack and watch Sparkle.
Too soon, maybe? I don't know.
She's not going to care. She's dead.
Jesus. All right. Danny.
Another movie comes out this Friday, although most people can just wait till VOD a week later, but Side by Side, new documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Hosted, produced by Keanu Reeves. It's great for movie geeks because there's plenty of interviews with Christopher Nolan, James Cameron, I don't know, a billion people that you'd like. But it's also very much geared towards a layman as far as the debate on film versus digital. I highly recommend that.
Yeah, it's very good.
Danny, did you have anything coming out?
I was going to say Side by Side too, actually, because I watched that a couple days ago. I'm actually really interested for it to get released because I wonder how it'll play for general audiences, because in terms of like a film nerd and watching it, like, it's really interesting, but I wonder how it'd play for an average person. So be interested to see what kind of reception that gets commercially.
I like how we're delineating ourselves as non-average people.
I'm not average, which isn't to say I'm above average, but I'm not average.
All right, so possibly below average Danny thinks that we should all check out Side by Side. That is the end of our look forward to the week ahead. We're going to give you our random selections of things that we've watched on our personal time, and then we're going to sign off. So, Chris?
Something that's not coming out, just something that I just saw randomly.
yeah, something from a while ago. Anything not like in theaters / new to DVD.
Well, I did just finally see the film, the documentary Baraka this week, which I think is gorgeous for something made any time, but the fact that it was made 20 years ago, I was surprised at how beautiful it is. I'm very jealous that I did not see it in 70mm, which some people in Austin will get to see soon. But I highly recommend that because the sequel, even though it's not really a narrative film, and even for documentary standards, the sequel comes out in 2 weeks. It's called Samsara. So I highly recommend everybody watch that, preferably on Blu-ray or in the theater if they're in Austin or anywhere else that it might play. I know it just played in New York City in 70mm, and then go see Samsara afterwards when it comes out.
All right, excellent. And Nick, what about yourself?
I'm going to go with Happy Together, which is a 1997 movie from Wong Kar-wai, the Hong Kong cinema icon that almost sort of rhymes. This is a sort of a domestic relationship drama. Well, that's a way of being very generic in the description, but it's about a gay man who is trying to sort of reconcile with the idea of living with his ex-lover, who has become kind of a bum and a straggler of sorts. Of course, because it's a Wong Kar-wai film, it's absolutely gorgeous, but it's also really moving, and it gives you like a lot to chew on too. You know when you see a movie and you're thinking after you watch it.
Yes,
that's what that movie's going to do to you.
All right,
never ever.
You just shrug it off.
Like water off a duck. Danny, what about yourself? What have you watched this week that you think people should check out?
I finally watched Claire Denis' White Material, which I'd kind of scrolled past in my Netflix queue for months for no real reason, but it popped up on the Sight and Sound list of one of my favorite writers. So when that happened, I thought I had to give it a look. It's really good. With watching it just after having someone put it as on their top 10 of all time, it's hard to feel completely satisfied. It wouldn't be in my top 10 of all time, but the filmmaking is, as you'd expect, incredible, and it's got a great lead performance, and all the technical aspects, the sound design in particular, is very striking.
All right. And for me personally, speaking of Netflix Instant, this past week I watched 13 Assassins by, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong.
Takashi Miike.
Takashi Miike. I was going to call him something completely different. Basic same letters, but completely different pronunciation. It's a movie, actually really recent. I was surprised to learn how recent it was. It's just from like last year. And it's the story of 13 samurai who are trying to murder or assassinate, I guess. I'm just trying not to use all the words that are in the title too much. They're trying to take down a shogun appointed, the person who's going to be the next shogun, who really is a sadistic jerk, like the worst possible human being on earth. And they want to kill him because they know that if he ascends to power, life is going to be hell for everyone. A lot of character building that leads up to an insane 45 minutes of straight up violence. The thing is, it's not gratuitous. It's not fantastical. There's a good stark kind of reality to it. It's great. You really care about the characters, even though there are 13 of them. You still get a pretty good handle on everyone. And like I said, it's on Netflix Instant, so you have no reason not to see it because it's right there in front of you, probably. So
say it's not gratuitous, but it's still pretty violent.
But I don't want to give the impression that it's like the crazy 88s fight from Quentin Tarantino played straight over 45 minutes. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's heavy, but it's not lingeringly violent. Yeah. Is that a better way to say it?
Sure. It certainly gives you sufficient reason to find the main villain to be evil. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. He's one of the best established evil sons of bitches on earth. 13 Assassins, check it out. Check out anything else we talked about. If anyone else has seen anything that they think we should check out ourselves, you can get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Remember to rate us and subscribe to us on iTunes because, yes, that is important. You can also leave a comment there. We're going to sign off, but first, let's give you an idea as to where we can be found online when we are not talking your ears off. Guess first, Chris, why don't you tell us where we can find you online?
Movies.com. I write regularly. I run the blog for the documentary channel, and every week I write about sequels for Screen Crush because I love them so much. I'm probably the only person who can say that.
Do you have a Twitter you want to throw out too?
The Film Cynic.
All right. And Danny?
TheFilmStage.com. I also have a personal blog at TheKingBulletin.com and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
All right. And Nick?
FilmStage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman. And just still trying to find my chems.
How many movies are you going to try to work chems into?
Well, if we review Paranorman next week, I'm sure there'll be some leeway there.
You're going to think there's a lot of illicit drug use that you can latch onto in that children's movie?
Should I save the joke? No, I'll save it for next week.
Okay. Something to look forward to for next week.
I'm setting up the next episode.
I'm glad to see that level of commitment. You can find me, obviously, at The Film Stage. You can also find my personal blog at dearfilm.net. And you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Brian spelled with an I, and there's no W in Rowan. Trying to hit all the bases on possible ways people could misspell my name. I hope I just did. So thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to speaking to you next week. Is Nick still here? That might be the problem.
Yeah, he's gone or something.
We've lost Nick. One of these days, people are going to make technology that just works. Hey, you're back.
Hey, I went to go click something, and I accidentally clicked because there's a little icon that floats over my screen when I don't have Skype, the app, when it's not directly open.
So I know.
The odds of me actually clicking that little red phone button are very small. So.
I was about to say, given the size of a computer screen, it should be difficult to hit that on accident.
Yeah.